This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Greetings of peace. My next guest, Dr. Professor Norman Finkelstein. For those that don't know who he is, let's check out this clip.
My late father was in Auschwitz. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on my father's side,
the Jews did not take arms against the
my
Germans.
My late father was in Auschwitz concentration camp. My late mother was in Majdanek concentration camp. Every single member of my family on both sides was exterminated. Both of my parents were in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it's precisely and exactly because of the lessons my parents taught me and my two siblings that I will not be silent when Israel commits its crimes against the Palestinians. And I consider nothing more despicable than to use their suffering and their martyrdom to try to justify the torture, the brutalization, the demolition of homes that Israel daily commits against the Palestinians. So I refuse any longer to be intimidated or browbeaten by the tears. If you had any heart in you, you would be crying for the Palestinians, not for what's been done.
Now, Dr. Professor Norman Finkelstein, in the year 2020, was named the fifth most influential political scientist in the world. He is the author of many books that have been translated into 60 foreign editions. He's devoted 40 years of his life to help people understand the facts as to what's really going on in Palestine, through the lessons that he learned from his own mother and father, who as Jews themselves were in concentration camps. Now, I'm going to go through five clips, God willing. And if he's up for it, we'll throw in a couple bonus clips on some of the main key actors who are out there and people who would probably be very, very terrified and scared to debate someone like Norman Finkelstein. So let's hear what they have to say, get a response to it. To save time, we're going to get right into the first clip from the Joe Rogan podcast here, one of his guests, and then we'll bring on our esteemed Professor Norman Finkelstein.
What do you think? I'm Israel, you're the Palestinians in Gaza. If every one of the people in Gaza laid down the arms and stopped attacking, what would I, Israel, do to you?
It's a good question.
Nothing. They've tried it five different times. They literally stop attacking. Israel has never, not one time in history, initiated any conflict. Every single one of those things that you're pointing to is a retaliatory attack by a terrorist organization. But if that was switched, where I, Israel, you, Hamas in Gaza, I take all of my arms and all of my protection and I laid them down, what would Hamas do? They'd kill every single one of us. That's what they do. That's what they're sworn to do. That's their motto and the origin of their existence, all the way back to the Grand Mufti traveling to Hitler to ask, how do we solve the Jewish problem? You want to follow from the Muslim Hamas to the Muslim Brotherhood, all the way back to the Grand Mufti, to Mujahideen, and you see the origins of one thing, which is, how do I solve the Jewish problem, is to eradicate and kill them. That is what Hamas came from. Not the Palestinians, not those poor people stuck in Gaza. But in that problem, if all of Hamas just went away, we would have peace. If they laid down their arms and they stopped murdering innocent civilians and raping women and killing babies, you'd have peace. If the other side laid down their arms, they would all be murdered.
This is Professor Dr. Norman Finkelstein on The Dean Show. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on your show.
Have you ever been on a Joe Rogan podcast?
No, I've never been on this.
I think Joe Rogan, when he watches this, we're going to go ahead and hopefully he'll have you on, because he's one of the biggest podcasts out there, and it'll be a shame if he doesn't have someone like yourself on. So hopefully you get an invitation from him soon, God willing. So what do you think, Dr. Moore? How you been? How's everything? I know you're a little tired. You've been going through a lot of the same things over and over. I watched your debate recently. I just have one question before you get into this. The guy from New York, it was in-person debate, And was he wearing, what was on his shirt? Was he wearing a Theodor Herzl t-shirt?
Yes, that was a portrait of Theodor Herzl, the founder.
Okay.
The person who's usually named, described as the founder of modern Zionism.
Yes. All right, so did you get a chance to listen to this clip?
Yes, I listened to it.
How would you respond to this?
It's hard to respond to statements like that because they're so demented, so divorced from reality that one doesn't really know where to begin. It starts with Hamas, goes back to the Mufti of Jerusalem, Muslim Brotherhood, and it's just gibberish. So let's just look at the basic facts. Hamas participated in democratic elections in 2006. Those elections were effectively imposed by the U.S. government. For your younger viewers whose memories don't go back to 2006, that's when George Bush Jr. was president, and he was engaged in what was called at the time democracy promotion. And one of his showcases of democracy promotion was the call for Palestinian elections in the occupied Palestinian territories. Hamas reversed itself because earlier it wouldn't participate in what it considered illegitimate elections. It decided to participate, and surprise to itself, it won the elections. Because the governing authority in the Palestinian occupied territories, the Palestinian Authority, it's called, was then and today, until today, remains very corrupt. So they were voted out of office, the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas was voted into office. What happened? Well, the elections, according to Jimmy Carter, former U.S. president, were completely honest and fair. And immediately as these completely honest and fair elections resulted in the Hamas victory, Israel, followed by the EU and the U.S., imposed these devastating economic sanctions on Gaza, which ground its economy to a halt. That's where, so to speak, all the troubles began. And in the past 20 years, Israel has controlled who goes in, who goes out of Gaza. It controls what goes in, what goes out of Gaza. About half the population over the past 20 years has suffered from what the international humanitarian organizations call extreme food insecurity. About half the population of Gaza is unemployed. Among youth, it's about 60%. It has the highest highest unemployment rate of any area in the world. Half the population of Gaza comprises children. So when you hear about Gaza, you have to bear in mind of those 2.3 million people living in Gaza, half are children. 70% are refugees from the first Arab-Israeli war and the descendants of refugees. So for the young people who broke through the gates of Gaza on October 7th, most of them, probably almost all of them, had been born into that situation I just described. Now, if you take all the separate facts about Gaza and you put them together, I didn't mention that Gaza is among the most densely populated places on God's earth. I didn't mention that Gaza is only 25 miles long. It's shorter than the marathon and about 5 miles wide. If you take all these facts together, the former British Prime Minister, conservative British Prime Minister David Cameron, he described Gaza as an open-air prison. A senior official in the Israeli government, he was a senior official in 2004, and he continues to be a very influential figure in Israeli life, in Israeli intelligence and military life. His name is Giora, G-I-O-R-A, Eiland, E-I-L-A-N-D. Giora Eiland, already in 2004, before the blockade, he described Gaza as, quote, a huge concentration camp. So those folks who burst through the gates of Gaza on October 7th, nearly all of them had been born into that huge concentration camp or open air prison. So all of this stuff that this guy talks about, if the people put down their arms, Hamas would kill them, it's just a flaming imbecile. And it would be kind of funny, to tell you the truth, were it not for the fact that, apart from what I just described in Gaza, I left out that periodically, every few years, usually on the order of 2 years, every few years, Israel goes into Gaza to what it calls mow the lawn. It's going to mow the lawn. So what is this lawn? I said there are 2,300,000 people living in Gaza, of whom 1,100,000 blades of grass on this lawn, 1,150,000 blades of grass, they're children. So when you hear mow the lawn, you have to bear in mind that it's the heads of children that are being mowed. And I'm not going to go through the statistics now. It was 2008-09, Operation Cast Lead. Hundreds of kids were killed. 2012, Operation Pillar of Defense. 2014, Operation Protective Edge, 550 kids were killed. In the current round, since October 7th, more children have been killed. More children were killed in 3 weeks than every other war zone in the world combined, be it the year 2020, 2021, 2022. If you take each of those years and add up every child killed in every war zone in the world, it would still not equal the number of children who have been killed in Gaza in the past 3 weeks. The number is about 4,500. Now, that number is going to soar now because, among other things, Israel is systematically targeting the medical infrastructure in Gaza. It's attacked several hospitals already, and right now it's beginning, so to speak, the final solution to Gaza, because it's attacking Al-Shifa Hospital, which is the biggest hospital in Gaza. It's as if in the United States you would attack the Mayo Clinic or Sloan Kettering Hospital or Johns Hopkins. It's the major hospital. Wow. And right now, as we speak, they have begun the assault on Al-Shifa Hospital. Now, they claim that Hamas's command and control center is underneath Al-Shifa Hospital. As a matter of fact, they say that every time they launch one of their high-tech massacres in Gaza. They said that in 2008. I talk about it in the book I wrote on the subject. And let's say anybody has any doubts on this subject, it's a very easy way to resolve the question. There are thousands of people in Gaza. Excuse me, there are thousands of people in Al-Shifa Hospital. Thousands. Reporters can go in and just check whether Israel says we have detailed evidence that there is a bunker in Gaza, excuse me, a bunker in Al-Shifa, where there's the Hamas command and control center. And they send out pictures of it, images of it. You could just go down and check. It's not difficult. But of course, they're never going to allow inspections. Because right now, the main goal of Israel is very simple. It's using October 7th as the pretext for the final solution of the Gaza question. And the final solution of the Gaza question has, I would say, two parts. One part is the utter the pulverization of all of Gazan society, to reduce all of Gaza physically to rubble. It's so far destroyed or damaged 45% of all the civilian dwellings in Gaza. So about half the population will have nowhere to go back to. In fact, they literally will not know where to go back to, in the most literal sense, because the whole area is going to be reduced to something between a garbage dump and a parking lot. It'll just be flat. So as you look for your home, you're going to be looking into a horizon, and you won't have a clue even where you lived. You won't know.
Wow. That goes into the next clip that I want to show you. It discusses peace, and it pushes out there this concept that they keep rejecting peace. So I'm going to play two clips back to back, because it seemed like these talking points are put out there by the same individuals often. I'll have you address that.
You're the one who made up things.
The Palestinians were offered a state in 1936 in the Peel Commission. They rejected it. They were offered a state in 1947, the UN partition plan. They rejected it. They were offered a state in 1967 after Israel conquered Judea and Samaria and the West Bank. They rejected it. They were offered a state in 2000, Yasser Arafat, Ehud Barak. They rejected it. They were offered a state with Ehud Olmert, 2008. They rejected it. Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza in 2005, and they did not create a state.
Claim is that the Arabs did not reject peace, and then in your own disquisition, you admitted that the Arabs rejected the Peel Commission plan, which was a separation between the Jews and the Arabs, which gave an extraordinary amount of land to the Arabs. The Arabs then rejected the peace partition plan proposed by the United Nations in 1947. They then proceeded to reject the Oslo Accords in 93. After that, they rejected the Y River Accords in 98. They rejected Ehud Barak's very generous offer in 2000.
I think they're kind of the same talking points of is this anything new that you've heard? Are you familiar with both of these figures here, Ben Shapiro and the another follower of Theodor Herzl?
I'm familiar with him. Impossible to disentangle all the nonsense that's being said there. So I'll limit myself to some very basic facts, which the record unimpeachably demonstrates. Since beginning in the early 1970s, long before Hamas even existed, the Palestinian leadership in the PLO, it was called the Palestine Liberation Organization, led by this fellow named Yasser Arafat. And the Palestinians were on record as supporting a two-state settlement based on the June 1967 border, what has come to be called the international consensus. Two states on the June 1967 border. And for the past 20 or so years, every year in the United Nations General Assembly, there is a resolution passed or a resolution put forth called Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. And the terms of the settlement are very straightforward. Number one, that Israel has to withdraw from the territories it occupied in June 1967, namely the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. Number two, the settlements Israel has built in the occupied Palestinian territories, now numbering about 700,000 or more Jewish settlers, are illegal under international law, and those settlements have to be dismantled. Number three, there has to be what's called a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return. And number four, the Palestinians should be able to exercise their right of self-determination in the territories from which Israel withdraws. Those are the terms of international law, and those are the terms embedded in that annual resolution, peaceful settlement of the Palestine question. Every year, the whole world, except the United States, Israel, and some South Pacific atolls, islands, Tuvalu, Nauru, Tonga, aside from those Marshall Islands, aside from them, the whole world votes on one side. Israel votes, Israel and the United States vote on the other side. That's the record. The whole world has been wanting to try to resolve this problem on the basis of international law and the basic principles as applied of international law as applied to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And Israel and the U.S. have rejected it. There are so many silly, stupid comments by those folks because they don't know what they're talking about. They just get Israel talking points and they have no clue what they're talking about. So that to me is the essence of, if you have any specific questions about specific claims that were made.
No, we can go to the next clip then. From here, we often hear this often. I've heard you also answer this, but for many of our audience who haven't, this is another key point that they always bring out to justify the ethnic cleansing, the genocide that's happening right now.
This is what's happening. Israel is basically saying, get the hell out of Gaza. We are coming full force for Hamas. We do not want to kill civilians. Please leave. Now, what is Hamas saying? Stay. We need you. We need you to stay here. Why? Because Hamas uses its citizens to protect Hamas, whereas Israel uses the IDF to protect its citizens. Let me say that again. Hamas uses its citizens to protect Hamas as human shields, whereas the IDF will protect its citizens. So if Hamas put down all their guns, all their weapons, there would be peace. If Israel put down all their guns and all their weapons, they would all be dead. The moral equivalency is not even close. So
human shields, it's often repeated. You've probably got sick of answering the question, but this is something that's used to justify the attack on civilians.
Human shielding isn't a precisely defined term in international law, but it generally refers to the conscription, the forcible conscription of civilians in order to protect either combatants or military sites. That's more or less, as I said, it's not a legal term. The evidence has not been legally defined, but that's generally how people use the term. The forcible conscription of civilians to either shield combatants or to shield military sites. Now, I've read the entire record, human rights record on the Israel-Palestine conflict since, I would say, probably since around 2000. I've read before 2000, but exhaustively beginning 2000. No, actually, I would say even earlier, probably the first Intifada. So that would be 1988. There's been no record of Hamas using, I have to be careful about these things because we're covering a long period. Hamas doesn't even emerge until the late 1980s. So let's just go to 2000, the first major operation, Israel's operations, its high-tech massacres, occurs in Operation Defensive Shield in 2002 when it went into Jenin, when Israel went into Jenin, the city of Jenin. So if you look at that whole period, let's just take one example which has been the most exhaustively documented, and that's the Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09. Amnesty International did the most exhaustive study of what happened during what Amnesty called the 22 days of death and destruction, namely the Israeli, what Israel calls the Operation Cast Lead. And it found no evidence that Hamas engaged in human shielding. Now, there are two further points I have to make. Point number one, there is a distinction in international law between what's called human shielding, which, as I said, is not a legally defined term, and what's called taking all feasible precautions, in the course of combat not to endanger civilians. Now, that does have a legal standard and a legal definition. You, in the course of combat, you're required by international law to take all feasible precautions to avoid civilian casualties. And there have been some cases, as would inevitably be the case when you're dealing with the most densely populated place on God's earth, there are going to be some places where Hamas is going to be firing a rocket or a projectile from a civilian area. That's just unavoidable given the nature of Gaza. So there has been some claims, not a lot, but some, and we want to stay faithful to the factual record, that Hamas hasn't taken all feasible precautions to wage combat away from civilians. But there's a second side to the story, which all the human rights organizations document. Yes, there has been a lot of human shielding. There has been a lot of human shielding going on in Gaza. But you know who's conducting the human shielding? It's Israel. Israel takes civilians and fires from behind them.
Wow. So this is documented by all the human rights organizations?
That's not even controversial. Israel takes civilians when it takes over an apartment building and places the civilians in front of the windows and then fires from behind the civilians. Israel takes civilians and forces them to sit beside tanks. There has been human shielding, and it's been widely and repeatedly documented. Yes, Israel has carried out the human shielding.
And when you go to Israel, 21% of the population is Arab. And out of that Arab, I think 12% are Muslim. They have political parties. They vote. They have freedom of speech. They're prosperous. I've been to many of their villages in northern Israel. And compared to anywhere else in Jordan or Egypt, Syria, Iraq, there's nothing like it. No Arab citizen anywhere in the Middle East has the freedom to express himself and to vote and to worship as he feels, as they do in Israel.
Your response?
Well, in the past few years, There have been several human rights organization reports on the situation, the legal status of Arabs, Palestinians in the area from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. There was one put out by B'Tselem, the main Israeli human rights organization monitoring the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. There was a report put out by Amnesty International. There was a report put out by Human Rights Watch. The first point to make is there isn't an occupation anymore. The occupation under international law, what distinguishes an occupation from an annexation or an illegal annexation is one thing. It's very simple. What distinguishes an occupation from annexation is an occupation is temporary. Well, Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. We're talking now about more than a half century. It's not temporary anymore. It's an annexation. So the first point we have to keep in mind is there is one state from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. That is the state of Israel. And as B'Tselem put it, there is one state, and that state is anchored in the principle of Jewish supremacy. Now, there are unequal levels of Jewish supremacy. In the case of the West Bank and Gaza, West Bank including East Jerusalem and Gaza, in the case of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and including East Jerusalem and Gaza, they have no rights. They have no right to vote. They have no rights whatsoever. They're basically a helot, a slave population.
Is he lying? Does he know this? Because he
Well, then we'll go on. He says, I said there are unequal rights. You have to remember, even in the United States before the Civil War, there were blacks who were free. It wasn't everybody, every black person was a slave. But nobody would make the ridiculous claim that blacks enjoyed equal, the free blacks enjoyed equal rights to whites in the pre-Civil War South. So it is true that in the portion, and we have to bear in mind it's just a portion, in the portion of that Israeli state that extends from the West Bank, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan, there is a portion, namely the Palestinian Arabs in Israel, who enjoy, they have the right to vote, that's correct. They have representatives in the Knesset, that's correct. My last recollection, it could be wrong at this point, but they had one Supreme Court justice, that's correct. But they were also second-class citizens. Nobody disputes that. That's just a silly thing to say. So what one can say is that there is one state, half the population of that one state, or nearly half of the population of that one state, nearly half, it would be about 4.5 million. Nearly half the population has no rights at all. And haven't had any rights since 1967. And then the other portion of the Arab population, namely the portion within the state of Israel, that is not the West Bank, not East Jerusalem, not Gaza, but within Israel itself, they enjoy some rights, but they're still, by all reckonings, they're still second-class citizens in a thousand different ways. It would be very difficult now to go through all the laws on the Israeli books which relegate the Arabs of Israel to a second-class status. You could say, Well, no, it wouldn't be exactly right. I can't find the exact analogy, but that's roughly the picture. So we shouldn't forget that when we're talking about Israel at this point, there's only one state. The area is the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza. They have been effectively and illegally annexed to the state of Israel. They are illegally annexed territories, but part of Israel.
Is this one state you're talking about, is this undisputed? Is this a fact that this is an apartheid state?
Well, I would say that two of the human rights reports I referred to, one by Amnesty International, and the other by B'Tselem, described the whole of Israel as an apartheid state. Human Rights Watch described the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, as an apartheid-like state, but they refer to the state of Israel itself as the Arabs having second-class citizenship, but not equal to apartheid.
And just a couple more questions before we conclude. I've heard you say, and this is, I want this to really sink into people's minds, and if their hearts haven't been darkened, you know, to have some kind of feeling, you know, otherwise they got to go see a cardiologist, and maybe the cardiologist not going to even help. When you mentioned more children have been killed in Gaza in the last three
weeks
than all.
At 3 weeks already, at 3 weeks already, it was more children killed than all the war zones in the world combined, either in the year 2020, 2021, or 2022.
Wow. And you mentioned this a week ago. So that was at 3 weeks. Yeah. We're into four weeks
now. Now it's up to 4,500. So, now there's going to be, to be clear, because now there's going to be mass death. There has already been mass death. Now there's going to be mega death because the whole medical system has collapsed. They're systematically targeting every hospital in Gaza now. So everyone in an incubator is going to die. It's the end of Palestine. And everybody from Joe Biden to Bernie Sanders, everybody who opposes a ceasefire now has oceans of blood on their hands. They have ocean. They are complicit in genocide.
Why do you think, I mean, and this can go into my final question here with the term never forget, does that include Palestinians? The lessons that you learned, what made you now come to where you are, where you put your career, you put everything?
Respect, I don't even want to talk about myself. You know, there's
a
complete catastrophe unfolding. It's the end, you know, it's their final solution. When you unabashedly, unashamedly, boldly, flagrantly, and blatantly target the hospital system of a country, then you are in neon lights, in Klieg lights, telling the world the goal now is the complete annihilation and pulverization of a people. That's your goal. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Finkelstein. Thank you very much.
Brothers and sisters, we've all had loved ones that passed away. A mother, a father, a brother, a sister, a close family member. But one of the mercies of our deen is that with the right intention, we can go ahead and continue to do good deeds on our loved ones' behalf. And what greater of a continuous good deed, sadaqa jariya, than investing on their behalf in the Deen Center and Masjid and Mega Dawah Center that will benefit generations to come, inshallah. So click the link below, donate right now. May God Almighty Allah reward all of you.
I cannot leave without giving you a gift. If you're not yet Muslim and you're tuning in to see what these Muslims are talking about and you like a free copy of the Quran, go ahead and visit thedeanshow.com. We'll take care of the postage and everything and get it delivered to you. And if you still have some questions about Islam, call us at 1-800-662-4752. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum. And if you like this episode of The Dean Show, like this video, share this video, far and wide and support us on our Patreon page so we can continue this work. Thank you for tuning in. Peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.